Welcome to Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I'm the host, Terry DeFellin, and I'm joined, as ever, by Derek Mantle.
Hiya.
And by Graham Sibley.
Hello.
How you doing, guys? All right?
Yeah,
Like ages since we were last around this table. Ages.
And we've run out of booze.
So it has been ages. Actually, no, it's not been ages at all, has it? You join us flicking through some very, very old books. Very old books. We have in front of us the Star Trek role-playing game, originally published by the good people of FASA, F-A-S-A, who were a thing in the 1980s. Not that video games weren't around, but Star Trek video games weren't around. And this is what young Trekkies did for kicks. When there was only the original series around, and when you didn't have that much access to the episodes.
I'm sure there were old Trekkies,
and indeed probably old Trekkies as well. And this is the basis of our discussion for the next 20, 30 minutes or so. And that is, well, Axanar, Prelude to Axanar, moving on from our last podcast, which is about Whom Gods Destroy. Hang on. and about Garth of Izar. And there's a massive backstory which was developed by FASA. Ah, yes. Graham has just showed me a passage from the Cadets Orientation Sourcebook from the Star Trek role-playing game, Encounters in Space. The following text was written by Garth of Izar, Captain Starfleet. It has been annotated and added by James T. Kirk. And it's all about the 4 Years' War.
Look at this one as well.
Yes.
This is what they used to do. They used to take characters, or they used to make up characters.
Yeah, I saw that. This is from the 4 Years' War supplement source book, and it's a passage, a UFP socio-political background, a criticism from On the Brink of Disaster, Federation Assistant, now High Commissioner, Michael Ferris, who was in
Galileo 7.
Galileo 7.
The one with the funny costume.
Yeah.
Yes, both shared a costume.
They
went on to write things.
That's a 4 Years' War. So this is basically telling the story in a short way of the 4 Years' War between the Klingons and the Federation, of which Garth of Izar was the fleet captain and was a protagonist, main protagonist, and pretty much responsible for Starfleet winning that particular war.
Now, this was officially licensed, wasn't it? I know the original,
this is all licensed,
the original FASA game, I don't think, was.
Starfleet Battles, no.
Well, no, there was Starfleet Battles, which was a desktop game, wasn't it? It was just it was basically a board game, wasn't it, really? But I think there was this was version 2 of the role-playing game, this one you've got
Here. Well, this is definitely licensed because it's got branding and stuff
It's got branding and everything.
And it's from Games Workshop.
I mean, that's the Games Workshop. It's a UK version, but it is essentially it's the same. It's FASA who did it. These expansion packs came afterwards. Return to Axanar, which is the scenario based upon the 4 Years' War.
Yeah,
the Return to Axanar is set in the time of the movies of post Wrath of Khan movies. The graphic, the visuals all have the Monster Maroon uniforms and. This is the basis for a independent or fan film called Prelude to Axanar, which is available on YouTube, which is a film that has developed a degree of notoriety for various reasons, which we won't dwell on, but it has. There's a follow-up due at some point, although we're not quite certain when, but it's based upon, and the director and the producer, Alec Peterson, is the guy who made it, is based upon this book.
The 4 Years' War.
Yeah, he said that this is where he got it from. So he's about our age, I think, and he probably played this when at the same time that we did. We would have been in Croydon playing this, and roughly at the same time, Alec and his mates were probably doing the same thing. I don't know whether we actually played this though. We played role playing game loads of times.
Yeah, I didn't get.
But I don't think we get a good. These are yours.
That's not mine. Those are.
I didn't buy them.
Oh, I didn't buy them.
I thought you bought them.
No, I didn't.
I thought you bought them and you kept them with me, and then I put them in the box then.
No, I think
the next
someone
time we played them, and then we grew up suddenly.
I wonder if Wayne bought them.
Could be Dorothy's. Oh dear.
Could be Dorothy's.
Well, Dorothy, if you're listening, I've got your books. Come and get them. He's not going to be listening.
No.
Yeah, so I just wanted to have ask you guys, what's your impressions of Predator Axanar? What did you think of it?
It was a very, very interesting concept to do, just to make a sort of documentary about something basically that refers to one line in an episode of Whom Gods Destroy. Yes, didn't say it. Yeah, with the whole thing about like your maneuver at the Battle of Axanar, yeah, basically, and that was it. And they make this.
All of this stuff that they produced, FASTA produced. We should credit the guy.
It must be hundreds of man hours, all of this, and woman hours,
but all based on one line from a not very good episode of Star Trek.
But all of this stuff, though, is produced by a number of fans, isn't it? It's a distillation of fan work. That went round
you're right. This is all based upon probably fan fiction, as you say, distilled.
Yeah.
Designed and written by John A. Thiessen, or possibly Thiessen, depending on how you go with it. But yeah, this guy, for all we know, could have been fairly active in the fan scene.
Yeah.
And would have read a load of Star Trek fans.
I would imagine he was. Yeah. There would have been no gatekeepers as well in that time for all this sort of stuff, which is great.
But the Starfleet Battles thing was very much a movement. It was a fan created, really a network more than anything else, or pre-internet, admittedly. But I mean, it was, and that's from where then FASA started to.
These were games, listeners, that were play by post, weren't they? A lot of them, these were. They were, so you'd have.
Oh, really? So they send stuff off.
You would know. You'd set up your. It was like a lot of military style.
Yeah.
The war games. There would probably only be about like a dozen or so moves in a game.
Mm-hmm.
But you would be able to move your things around, and I never actually played it. I knew people who did, but
it was slightly before my time. I was a little bit too young for that. I personally don't have the patience for that kind of game. But I loved the role playing game, and played it a lot. You were the GM for our
company, because they had so much information in it, and this sort of stuff that back then you didn't get. Compendiums and the compendium was Alan Asherman's compendium was
back
out.
Then this was all there was there was only the original
but Michael Okuda hadn't written God knows how many technical books on Star Trek. These were as close as you could get but considering this was pre-internet, the communication between these guys must have been incredible.
Sorry, was this before Next Generation?
Definitely between those
well
two
we've got this here is, these
this is, 83, 84, I would imagine.
Yes.
That's the Star Trek 3.
This is
3,
the Star Trek 3 sourcebook update.
Oh, yeah.
So this is an addendum to the existing role-playing game to bring you into the movie timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Because up to that point, this game was set in the TOS era. It wasn't. There was only Star Trek, the original series, what we now call the original series. Mm. It was only Star Trek, and that was it. And then apart from the movies, I mean, when I first got this would have been mid-80s. We'd have had the first three movies.
Yeah.
And that's it.
But it's interesting, what I find interesting is that nowadays people would look at these books here and say that the basic books that you get in the box are, in inverted commas, canon. And this stuff, which you see with the Return to Axanar Before Years War, is non-canon.
Or side canon.
Non-canon.
Non-canon, side canon. Okay.
It doesn't even matter.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but there are people who would argue that this is what they would call side canon.
And there are people who would argue, and that's the real key thing, isn't it? Because
it's a valid argument, mate.
It shows you what Star Trek has become. It's become something that has got apocrypha. It's got something that you've got ideas of saying, well, that idea is something because it appeared in a TV show.
But this is the thing about Star Trek in general. The thing is that in the last episode we were talking about how we were introduced to Star Trek. I mean, it is a case of it builds up a fandom. And the thing is that you go back to the original Star Trek, all the way, you know, when it the only the three series that it had, And when it went off air, the actual main series was syndicated, wasn't it? And so it actually got out to even more people and built up a fan base, and people still wanted more of Star Trek. And it took the letter writing campaigns and all this stuff, and then the start of the conventions and the
and the fact that the fans felt that they had contributed to its actually survival, to its survival for a long time, also gave them a lot more ownership.
Well, that's what I was going to say, ownership.
And exactly. That's an important thing.
I mean,
isn't it?
And you get that now. I mean, we are in the midst of, as we're recording this, there is a big argument going on about Discovery. And a lot of that argument is also based on people who don't like Discovery are often people who also, it would seem, like Prelude to Axanar and feel that Axanar is, if you like, the keeper of the soul of Star Trek, and that this Star Trek Discovery is inauthentic, and yet it's the official CBS TV show. It's called Just Die. So
yeah, I mean, there is, you know, I think you said that word official, isn't it? It's what people like to think of what a storyline or a franchise is like, and what it actually is to earn money. And obviously, Discovery is something that we've spoken before. It's about something to introduce Star Trek to a new generation of TV viewers, and hopefully to get a lot more fans in it, rather than to keep old fans happy.
Yeah.
It probably will keep old fans happy.
I think it probably
will have to keep nodding to it.
Yeah.
But we've seen it recently in Star Wars new films, which are really there just to keep...
Well, they keep the old fans.
Old fans happy. Yeah, old fans.
Yeah, particularly Rogue One, for example, which is very much
full of fan wank.
That is essentially fan fiction.
Well, fan wank, and also it's like the children from the original series, obviously the original films. Now they want to introduce stuff to their children, and they pull them along to watch the films. You know, I've done that myself. You know. And, you know, I did that with Doctor Who, but now my kids won't watch Doctor Who with me.
Well, there's another franchise that...
Yeah,
that
it's quite similar. Yeah.
But I think with the Star Trek stuff, you do get this thing where there is an official statement of what canon is, and it's got to be in the TV series or on the films. But you think, well, okay, well, you've got books that are written by the people who wrote these episodes... and you've got side projects that have been produced with the original actors in it, and you've also got you've also got a new thing then. Well, not a new thing anymore. For the last 20 years, I mean, any sort of thing with a video game, and especially like the new sort of virtual reality video games now, which are produced by the people who produce the episodes, are these part of the whole thing? Do they tell the whole story? And really, it's up to you as an individual to decide what you like and what you don't. Cherry pick. That's what they do.
I was going to ask about going back to the fan sort of like fandom as such. From the original series, were there cases where people who were big fans and in fandom during the sort of 70s, Were any of those people, did they actually end up in the Next Generation and later Star Trek sort of like franchise series? You know, stuff like they did in Doctor Who over here. We had a lot of people who were involved in Doctor Who were big fans of the old Doctor Who during the 70s.
Well, a lot of the old actors came back, didn't they? Well, in different roles, didn't they?
But I'm just wondering if people who, the writers and people...
Are you asking whether or not the people who were around in the 1970s and 80s and were producing content... when went on to work on the official series.
Yeah,
I don't believe so, personally. Would you? What about you?
Was it harder to get into, I suppose, in the States?
It might have been, or they might just have not... Yeah, they might have just decided not to do it. And it might also have been that those people didn't produce, didn't go into a career in television or into creative arts. They might have just not done that. A lot of the people that you're referring to, in Doctor Who, went on to become writers, professional writers,
and
producers. And then, so they sort of started on...
And they were really big and really important.
Well, they cut their teeth
on
fanzines, Doctor Who fanzines.
Yeah.
And they used that as the experience to then get them into a career
amount of work that went into these things, these scenarios and the source books and stuff like this, you'd think that if they've got that talent to put so much into it,
Yeah.
Would they have actually ended up?
The quality of this isn't great. Don't kid yourself. It's not brilliant. It's not brilliant.
It's a bit unkind. It's lovingly put together.
Yeah, but they're lovingly. It's a labour of love. But it is fan stuff. And fan fiction, you do have to, you do approach it with, you know, a little less of a critical eye. But if you do take a critical eye to it, you think, well, yeah, okay, you've just written your own little fantasy here, haven't you? So
this has got the timeline of Star Trek history here and the source book update, the Star Trek 3 source book update, you know, which, I mean, is probably not canon. But, I mean, I remember reading this vigorously and soaking it all up.
Well, you remember that Best of Trek book I gave you?
Yes.
That was the bit that I used to read a lot. They had the similar thing in there, and they had eugenics wars and all that sort of stuff.
For all we know, a lot of this may well have been passed into canon.
Yeah.
I mean, Michael Okuda is the guy who...
The problem is, with canon, is the fact that if you're saying everything you hear in an episode, everything you feel to see in a film, that's canon. But unfortunately, it does contradict itself a hell of a lot. Things change, people's names change, the planets change, and history changes quite a lot. And so you say, well, actually, your fan stuff is actually more clued up than the writers you've got.
It's funny because, I mean, Discovery did hire people specifically to, Kirsten Beyer, for example, is in the writer's room, who has written an awful lot of Star Trek original fiction, in the original novels, and she is part of the team that is there to observe canon through the production of Discovery, with a view to keeping it faithful to canon. But of course, canon in this instance is only been what has been broadcast.
Yeah.
Or, you know, on the TV show or what has, you know, in the movies.
Which starts another line to say, well, what about when you've got the source books that the writers are using? You know, the notes that the producers make or the writers' groups make about each character and the information they use from that, and they put in first drafts of scripts.
The Bible, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the H series has a Bible, doesn't it?
And
yeah.
How that gets into, even though some of the stuff doesn't even get into as far as the screened episode, but still gets out into the fan stuff.
Yeah, and then gets used.
I think an interesting example of that is McCoy's backstory. Which I think DC Fontana wrote an episode called Joanna, or it had his ex-wife in, and I think it became the Way to Eden, and it was changed so much.
Right,
she had her name taken off of it.
Right. Because it was Chekhov's old flame in the Way to Eden, wasn't it?
Mm.
Oh, was that originally going to be?
I think it was. Yeah. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
So that's the, well, I don't know if it was or not, but that's it got changed so much.
Yeah, but that
introduced the idea that McCoy entered Starfleet because he just came out of a divorce and
the only thing he had left was his bones.
But then again, that's gone on into books and comics.
The ill-fated, very very bad Marvel run of post-motion picture comics has an episode with McCoy's daughter.
Right,
the reference is given to Joanna, the wife. So, she turns up in IDW comics as well. So they do take that.
And these are officially sanctioned; they are licensed products, but they don't the. Yeah, the people read them and they enjoy them and it enriches their experience of Star Trek.
But they're not canon.
I used to.
I think canon's a personal thing.
I think, if the modern phrase is head canon.
I'm getting confused.
There you go.
So this is what Graham has said.
Slash fiction.
Cherry picking.
It's slash fiction. We're running out of time.
Let's let you read the word.
Do you know what? Floats your boat, though.
Depends how dirty your head cannon is, mate. If you've got a filthy head cannon.
Has anyone actually read anything?
Yeah, I don't know. If you want to go and grab your head cannon and...
No, but I've got a Macintosh right here, mate. Please, help yourself.
Dirty one as well.
A dirty Macintosh.
I have no idea what I was about to say.
Yeah, your head cannon.
So basically, if you think about ways that... The things that seem inconsistent. in an episode of Star Trek.
Imagination.
And then you imagine how to explain around it. And say, well, in my head, canon, this. And then and
your head, canon.
So that's how you do it. And it's pretty straightforward. Yeah. And it's a good way of not getting caught up in these kind of canonical crises that a lot of people do find themselves getting up in. When I was a kid, I used to get the inconsistencies and incontinuities in the original series used to drive me up the wall. I used to get so annoyed.
So he used to morph into a comic book guy from The Simpsons.
I did. You didn't know me when I was a teenager. He did, and these things used to drive me up the wall. I used to read the DC comics. And during the DC comics,
rip them apart.
Listen. During the DC comics, right after Star Trek 2, no, after Star Trek 3, when they brought Spock back, right? Spoilers. And they carried on the comics. Listen, they carried on the comic books, right? And they put Kirk in the Excelsior. So at the end of Star Trek 3, when they're in this limbo period, the DC comics still had a contract to carry on. So they put Kirk in the Excelsior.
Well, the Enterprise was destroyed.
They just like sent Spock away. The Enterprise was destroyed. They put Kirk in, they took him away from Vulcan, put him in the Excelsior, and they told a number of stories with minor Spock. And that clearly was the contractual arrangement they had to do. So they all carried on in the Excelsior for the 2-3 years until Voyage Home came along. And then by the time Voyage Home came along, they had to rewrite back in them going back to Vulcan so they could get back into the clear. And it drove me up the shitter.
Did you read the Marvel Star Wars comics though?
No, I didn't. I couldn't.
See, in the late 70s, this is a similar thing.
Oh, yes.
Between the films.
I love
it. They had loads of adventures.
Yeah. Well, I remember it was
the... Is that how they made it work?
We're trying to shoehorn them back in.
The thing is that I remember Darth Vader supposedly had spun off into space at the end of Star Trek 1 or Star Trek 4.
Star Wars, sorry.
Pod Destroyer, God. Yeah. In the series, straight after the adaptation of the Star Wars story, they brought Darth Vader back. Somehow he got himself back, and then he employed a load of bounty hunters, and one of them was a giant rabbit. And
you've got to get hold of some of these.
But this was before Boba Fett.
Was it the same giant rabbit? Rabbit from Shore Leave.
Well, there was a giant rabbit with who looked a bit like Han Solo, because he had the same. And he had a cyborg as well. And the idea they were trying to hunt down Han Solo, which, funny enough, sort of tied in with the Boba Fett stuff.
Yeah,
which was this was quite a few years before.
Wow.
I think this is the thing when you have licensed products, isn't it? And they're allowed to go ahead and do.
Yeah, no, you can get. Yeah, but I mean,
like, and no one gave a rat's crap about.
Nobody, apart from the people reading them, who got ludicrously and unnecessarily uptight about it. I'm collecting the Eagle Moss reprints, and they're due to be in there, so I'm looking forward to them. Diane Duane, the noted author, Diane Duane, wrote a couple of those in between. Somebody wrote a sequel to Wolf in Fold in that, which was actually quite enjoyable. And there was a really nice one that Diane Duane, she wrote a couple, and they were both very, very lovely stories. Mm. So I mean, and I think that's probably why I got a bit uptight about it, because there were such good stories.
Can we give a hat tip to Len Wein while we're doing...
Len Wein passed away only a few, about a week ago or so, who wrote a number of those DC comics. And he wrote some Gold Key comics as well. Mm. Created the new X-Men. Len Wein,
yes,
mm-hmm.
Actually, not Chris Claremont. Chris Claremont, he also
created Wolverine in the Hulk.
Yes,
he did. Len Wein, great writer, passed away sadly, and made a mark on the Star Trek side canon.
I met him once.
Did you?
Yes.
Wow. Tell us.
And at a comic convention, and he was just a really genial. Everyone said he was such a lovely guy. And he was over here. Because he was meeting a lot of the British artists and writers at the time, because they were doing a lot of the coming over and harvesting all our talent and bringing them back to the States. And I just met him once. Really nice guy. He even gave me a badge, I believe, at the time. Mm. So, and I remember it was just like a normal sort of school dinner table, canteen table place right at the back of this room where he had like all of it. I mean, I remember probably next to him was actually Simon Bisley, and he had like this long queue. But you know, Len had hardly anyone speaking to him at the time. It's always the way, isn't it? Yeah. So people don't know who this person
is. But you being considerably smarter than the fanboys.
Probably, yes. Yeah. Because I had actually heard...
that's Len Wein, that is.
Yeah, well, I had...
I'm going to go over and talk to the guy who created the X-Men.
Well, I did sort of seek him out. The X-Men because
and Swamp Thing.
Yeah, but I did... Well, that's it, the Swamp Thing. I'm just going to say, that's why I went to him, because I had spoken to Alan Moore probably a year before, when Alan Moore first started Swamp Thing, and Alan Moore was going on about how he was such a really good guy to talk to, because he's the person who actually really got him over to the States.
One day, listener, Derek's going to write a book about the 80s comic scene, and it's going to be a fantastic book. He may need a ghostwriter, but he is going to write that book.
I think the comic scene was probably...
Someone to like open up the blanks in his mind.
Yeah, that too, yes. Yeah.
But going back to the comics, the comic fanzine, in the fandom, it was obviously the same sort of thing as Star Trek.
Mm.
You know, the people made networks, and I made networks to you through a comic shop,
through the Phantom Zone,
and to you, and so on. That's the way you do it.
I presume as well that in America there might have been it might have been easier. There may have been comic stores long before they were over here. I mean, for us, I mean, we only had one comic store in London, really, and that was
for a while.
Planet, and that was a long time. During the '80s, that changed. They were opening up all over the place, but. Yeah,
Forbidden Planet would have been very much the hub. Did you spend much time on Forbidden Planet?
I did, but there was a shop before Forbidden Planet, around the corner in St. Denmark Street, called Dark They Were and Golden Eyed, where I got my first copy of the Marvel Star Trek comic. I remember buying issue one there.
Was that on Denmark Street?
It was very...
Well, it was 23 Denmark Street.
It wasn't Denmark Street, it was the alleyway which was between...
Oh, there was the one you had to go upstairs. We've and you had to you had no, to no, hand your bag.
No. That was a different one.
That was a different one. That was very, very seedy.
That was seedy. Yeah.
that was Tim Panelli, the one you're thinking of.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. We tried to sell copies of Ground Zero to that guy, and he wouldn't buy them, would he?
Yeah, well, that's typical. Yeah.
He was a grumpy old guy. He was the original comic store guy for me.
He was definitely.
It was pleasing to see that stereotype is the same in America when I saw that Simpsons character comic book. Guy. So they have him over there as well.
He was a guy when you used to go in there, if you had a carrier bag, you had to give it to him, and he would give you half a playing card.
Half a playing card.
He gave you half a playing card, and he'd pin your bag up behind there with the other half of the playing card
on the
hooks behind his car. And this place was tiny. It was about It was probably about 15.
But it had some good stuff in it, though.
So it had some great stuff in it, and it was cheaper than.
In fairness, it would have been nothing but teenage boys going in. We probably would have nicked stuff as well because there were so much cool things in there, and we had no money. So I often went into those places with no money at all and just like went, want. Anyway, just quickly going back to the Fours, because I always wanted to get this in. Editor's note on the 4 Years' War, a supplement. The editor of this is Sir Kenneth A.F. Brighton.
Right.
Nice to know that they still have knights in
the Knights of the Realm
in the 23rd century.
And called Kenneth as well.
Professor of Psychohistory. So what does that tell you?
Well, psychohistory was the stuff that was in the Asimov stories.
That's from the Foundation novels. Yeah. Psychohistory. Was it Harry Seldon was the professor of psychohistory at the beginning of that? And Asimov, obviously, and Roddenberry, and Asimov and Star Trek. So probably lifting a little bit from there as
Big
well.
Big sci-fi fans there, aren't you? Yeah. Massive. Deep sci-fi.
Deep, this is deep cut shit. This is.
Yeah.
It's glorious.
We haven't mentioned much about the Prelude to Action art.
We haven't. No.
No, I mean...
But did you notice also that was narrated by John Gill? Not, it wasn't literally narrated by him, but the credit on the front of that document was narrated by John Gill, who was the guy from Patterns of Force, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So, Professor, the historian from Patterns, of course. So he's the guy. They obviously it's not he's an actor,
mm-hmm.
but the as part of the introduction to that mockumentary of the documentary in Ready to Act Now, they said it was narrated by John Gill.
Okay, because I really enjoyed that Prelude to Act Now, but I did find it a bit confusing on the internet or the interwebs. The thing is that trying to track down the history of it, because there's all this links to the full video of the thing, which doesn't exist. It just takes you to a load of.
In short, because we really don't want to get into this.
Yeah, no, okay.
It was crowdfunded 20 minutes, and then they crowdfunded for a feature length episode, and then CBS took them to court. And then things went very nasty from then on, and still are. It is going to happen, but it's going to happen within the new fan fiction guidelines, so it's going to be 2 15-minute episodes. But this is a very divisive and very unpleasant subject for a lot of Star Trek fans, including mm-hmm. me, and I don't want to talk about it on this podcast. But I just wanted to use it as a jumping-off point for a discussion on side canon. And I think we can use that for more discussions on side canon and original fiction.
I can see you we'll have to buy you a drink after
this.
You
can see my pain, okay. No, but seriously, it is, and like every time somebody posts shit on it, I mean, people just go, and there's a big argument, and it's just not an argument. We are just way too cool for that kind of...
Yeah, it's stuff. Only... Star Trek is great, but it's only a TV
it's
series.
It's only a TV show.
And book, and a stage show, and some music, and...
And podcasts.
And podcasts.
Many podcasts.
And everything else.
Yeah.
And
it's also...
Did anyone buy Star Trek and Across the Universe? I was just seeing if anyone did.
No.
But there you go. You see, Star Trek can be many things to many people.
And will continue to be.
That's obviously in your head canon. Isn't it?
Yeah. In my head canon.
Your goodness knows what's in his head canon. Then we'll leave you with that, listeners, because I think we've had enough. Thank you for listening to Whom Pods Destroy. If you're listening to this podcast via a web player, then we hope you'll consider subscribing via Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or any other podcatcher you choose. Go to whompodsdestroy.com for all the feeds you need. If you already subscribe, then please do leave a 5-star rating for this podcast. Healthy ratings alert the oracles that run the podcast aggregators to our presence and help to promote the show. Thanks again for listening, and from myself, Terry DeFellin, from Graham Sibley, and from Derek Mantle, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.